Hello and welcome to Beyond Reproach.
Yes.
This is Tux Lerzel.
This is Stephanie Domingo.
And we come to you from Bushwick, Brooklyn, where we record on land belonging to the Lenape Nation, a nation that is one of many still very much out here doing its thing, and we would like to acknowledge that.
We sure would.
Beyond Reproach is the show about scandals and scandalousness in American politics and government. As per usual, we be drinking and we be swearing.
As per usual, I'm like, wait, where am I? I'm lost.
It has recently come to my attention. Today, we're going to be drinking...
We're drinking a beautiful cocktail.
It's so pretty, right?
It is like frothy. It looks like it's like bejeweled.
Delicately pink.
Yes. With raspberries
on top.
Delicately pink.
Yes. It's wearing a little raspberry beret.
That's my new band.
This is a cocktail that was really popular at the beginning of the 1920s.
Yes.
It is called a Clover Club.
Okay.
Clover Club. According to the old Waldorf Astoria bar book, the Clover Club was first created in the late 1800s, probably around the 1880s, in the bar of the Bellevue Stratford Hotel in Philadelphia. This was a very popular hangout for crowds of writers and lawyers and titans of industry in Philadelphia, where they would meet and talk over cocktails, and the elegant Clover Club was... a favorite among them.
That sounds grand.
Yes. It's made with gin, lemon juice, raspberry syrup, and egg white.
Oh, that sounds perfect.
Yeah.
All the flavors that I love.
Right? Yeah. It was funny to me when I was looking for a cocktail. Obviously, I knew that your story was from the 20s, so I'm looking for cocktails that were big in the 20s. And I saw that this had this raspberry syrup in it. I was like, that's weird because... I knew that raspberry syrup was really popular in the 1800s, but by the 1900s, we were using grenadine for most cocktails. Mm. So it's like, why did this have raspberry syrup in it? And then finding out like, oh, okay, it's from the 1800s. That's why.
Oh, okay. But it was just popular in the
20s. Yeah. Okay. I did read that a lot of people try to make the Clover Club today with grenadine instead of this raspberry syrup.
Boo.
Probably because, yeah, I know.
It's cheaper.
Yeah. Well, it's in, easier like, to find.
Oh, okay.
And you don't have to make your
own.
This raspberry syrup is something that I had it on hand because I have made frozen 1800s cocktails before. Mm-hmm. It called for it. So it was in the freezer. But according to Gaz Regan, who wrote The Joy of Mixology, you have to use the OG raspberry syrup. Don't use grenadine because, quote, without it, this drink isn't much to talk about.
Oh!
Yes. I also don't recommend trying to make this without the egg white.
I know.
But I also would not recommend trying to make this without the egg white. A lot of people try to do that, make sours and things without egg white.
Oh, no. Like with sour mix?
Or just like without it, just like lemon and sugar. Mm. But like the velvety sort of frothy mouthfeel is like, that's half the point of drinking an old school cocktail.
And also
like
the
this.
Look of it. It's not so be pretty. Frothy.
That froth on top is so pretty.
It's like a latte.
Yeah, totally. This cocktail sort of grew slowly from this hotel bar in Philadelphia. And by the late 1910s, early 1920s, it was a nationwide sensation. Everyone was drinking Clover Clubs. After Prohibition, it sort of basically faded away into obscurity. By the 1950s, it was almost completely forgotten.
Damn.
It's probably because A, nobody used raspberry syrup anymore.
Okay.
They wanted to use grenadine instead. And B, there was another cocktail called the Pink Lady that was sort of taking over for the Clover Club that is made with grenadine, but it's not just grenadine. They also add Applejack.
Oh.
So I feel like the Applejack must sort of help add the back tartness. Whatever, like something extra that you lose if you're trying to make this with grenadine. Mm. I don't know if it's tartness or what, but it's something. It gives it something interesting that like you're going to want to drink a Pink Lady. I've never had a Pink Lady, but I've heard that they're good. Another difference, though, is that while the Clover Club was created for this sort of like smoky, manly, dark wood paneled bar... Mm-hmm. The Pink Lady was seen as a woman's drink.
Oh.
Because it's pink. And
it has lady in the name.
Exactly. Yeah. And it was like a later era. By the 50s, people were like, pink drinks? That's gay.
Oh, my God.
You know?
How disappointing.
Masculinity is very fragile.
Yeah. This is a masculine cocktail?
Well, I think in like the 1880s, they didn't care. They were like, it's delicious.
And that is the correct attitude to have.
But by the 50s, they're like, no.
No, this drink is going to turn me.
Yeah, exactly.
Are you that on the edge, sir?
Well, I mean, it was the era of like the lavender scare where they were coming after you if you were drinking a pink frothy drink in a pretty glass.
Trash.
Yeah. Either way, the Clover Club was super popular in the 1920s. It was almost lost to history, but thankfully it is now popular again, thanks largely in part to its inclusion in Gaz Regan's 2003 book, The Joy of Mixology, and to the 2008 opening of a now famous cocktail bar in Brooklyn called The Clover Club. Have you ever been to The Clover Club? It's in Cobble Hill, I think, on Smith Street.
Okay.
It's supposed to be, I've never been there
it's
either.
It's like a cocktail bar?
Yeah, yeah. Hmm. And it's supposed to be like really, really sort of famous and great. They've been around since 2008.
Yeah, but it sounds like it's off to G, so
yeah. Ain't nobody got a time for that. That's the Clover Club. Oh, before we take a taste.
To Sharon!
Yes, to Sharon Cho, our newest Patreon
supporter.
Sharon is a longtime listener. She's been with us like, she's an OG.
Yeah.
And friend of the Joe.
I'm sure she has a friend named Joe, or many a friend.
Yes. She's also a friend of the show, as well as the Joe. So thank you, Sharon.
Yes, thank you.
We love that. That was very exciting to see.
Really appreciate the support and the love. Yeah, it was so nice to see your name come through.
Yeah, totally.
Did I know her?
Yeah. All right, so cheers to Sharon.
Cheers to Sharon. Clink.
When I was a kid at school, learning the golden rule, teacher often used to say, if you don't tell a lie, there's not a reason why you can't be like Washington someday. How could Washington be a married man and never, never tell a lie?
Wow.
I thought it was going to be sweeter than that. It's perfect.
Yeah, I love the gin in it. Like, the gin goes so well with the, like, tartness of, I guess, the lemon and the raspberry combined.
Oh, it's so good. I think sometimes a lot of raspberry syrups are probably sweeter than this, so it might be sweeter if you make it at home and you buy a raspberry syrup, but this is, I'm sure.
Oh, that's really, really good.
Hell yeah.
This is the ticket.
Right? Why have I not been drinking these all along?
That was me, you guys.
You did it.
I did it very slowly when you weren't looking at me. I'm getting there. I don't want to say I've been practicing every week, but
it was your New Year's resolution.
It was. So yeah, jumping into my scandal. I'm going to take another sip real quick, though. So our founding ideals promise liberty and justice for all. But JK, LOL, I mean, from your reaction, priceless.
Psych.
Yeah, the joke's on all of us.
Yeah.
So a racial hierarchy has been violently, but more importantly, legally sanctioned and maintained for centuries here. You know, we all know that that's kind of the gag. It's an ideal, but, you know, reality hits and our reality does not match our ideals. People on the right who claim to be like really into the founding fathers' ideals, who are, you know, constantly filleting the founding fathers, they're not in the street like protesting anti-Asian violence because of the founding ideals.
Constitutional scholars.
Oh my God, eye roll. So I've mentioned in passing that the U.S. has a racial caste system. In viewing it via this lens, I think is a more accurate reframe of the power structures at play. However, when most Americans think of a caste system, they think of India.
Yeah, totally.
Like growing up, I remember learning about the Dalits, like the what they considered untouchables, who were, you know, born through no fault of their own into the lowest caste system in their society.
It's funny when you learn about that in school, you're like, that's not fair. How could they do that? And it never dawns on you like, ever. We have that too here.
We have it here too. And also, I was born into that caste. Yeah, I know. Like, what the fuck? Yeah. Why wasn't that in the lesson plan?
Well, because we can't look ourselves in the mirror. You know what I mean? Like,
so Isabel Wilkerson, she's the one who kind of changed my whole thinking about... She wrote a book called Caste.
Okay.
It's called Caste, Origins of Our Discontent. She wrote this in 2020, like summer 2020, like everyone was thinking and talking about race. She's a scholar, and I bought the book, and it's very dense because it's a scholarly work, and like all the citations. It's really, really good. Highly recommend it. But she describes the structure as a caste is an artificial hierarchy granting or withholding of respect, status, honor, attention, privileges, resources, benefit of the doubt, and human kindness to someone on the basis of their perceived rank or standing in the hierarchy. She went on to say that what some people call racism could be seen as merely one manifestation of the degree to which we have internalized the larger American caste system.
Totally. Yeah. Right? I mean, we've said this plenty of times before that like race and class are so deeply ingrained and intertwined.
Intertwined. Yeah.
But like different leaves on the same branch.
Yes. We have a caste that's racially subdivided.
Yeah, exactly.
My story today involves this system as affirmed by my favorite court.
The Supreme Court?
The Supreme Court. I feel like we've gone pretty far into this season and I haven't done a SCOTUS scandal. So 'twas overdue.
Yes.
Now's my time. So my scandal this episode, do you know?
No, I don't. Okay. It's not what I thought it was going to be.
Okay, cool. Yes. So, so my scandal this episode is the 1923 Supreme Court case of the United States versus Bhagat Singh Thind.
Oh, no. Never heard of it.
Yes. No one has. This was a legal battle in which a high caste Punjabi man from India fought to gain American citizenship through his proximity to whiteness.
Oh, because he's high caste.
Yup. Oh, my goodness. But first a toast.
But I'm
look at
I'm on. At the top. What do you can't. Oh, Lord.
Yes. So let us raise our glasses to continuing to dismantle the model minority myth.
Yes, please.
Cheers.
Cheers.
But also just as a side note to my Asian sisters and brothers, and also just all people of color, there's nothing minor about us. We are the fucking global majority.
Yeah.
We have been since the 50s. We need to lean into that shit.
Yeah, totally.
So I want to start with a quick history of South Asian American immigration in this country. So... regardless of faith, anyone who moved here, who emigrated from the Indian subcontinent, was labeled a Hindu.
Wow.
Like, oh, what do you practice? Oh, Islam. Oh, you're Muslim. No, you're Hindu. Oh, we're going to call you Hindu. You over there in the turban. Sick? No, you're Hindu. Yeah.
Okay.
Everyone was a Hindu. So more than 100 years before actual communities of Hindu people made it to the States, their teachings, their spiritual scriptures, like made it here and were profoundly influential with the American Transcendentalist movement.
Yeah.
Do you know anything about that?
A little bit.
The movement, it saw like divinity in everything, like all living things, which is, you know, it's a beautiful sort of philosophy. They didn't like the concept of like some old man looking, staring down on you from heaven. Yeah. 'Cause
that's silly.
Yes.
You do you.
Yeah. To each their own.
Yeah.
So Henry David Thoreau and Ralph Waldo Emerson were leading like hype men of the Transcendentalist movement in this country.
Okay.
And they were the main people who were really adapting this really old tradition like in India for an American market.
Huh. Okay. Yeah, I mean I've read Walden. You know, but like I guess I didn't really realize that it was, I mean, of course it was borrowed from someone else, because a white American man is not going to come up with this shit on his own.
He was putting his own stank on it.
Yeah.
He took away the collective. He added the individual.
Imagine that.
So there is this, you know, a select group of white people in the Northeast, kind of the upper echelon intellectual sort of class of people, were totally on board with Indian immigration. They're just like, you know, these people have so much to teach us. They're like
enlightened. Yeah.
Yeah. This, I know, which is kind of gross.
It's very, yeah.
It's not great. So these people in the Northeast, they're just like, okay, like these people have some merit. There are things that they can teach us. Like, it's going to be fine. However, people on the Pacific Northwest were being people on the Pacific Northwest. Yes. They weren't super jazzed about this small group of people immigrating from India on their turf. So the first significant wave of immigration from South Asia occurred in the late 1800s.
Okay.
Many were fleeing British violence, the violence of colonialism, because it was British India back then.
Yes.
But they came here for a brighter future, like all the other immigrants in the country at the time. They found jobs in lumber mills and on farms because the West was still very underdeveloped. Similar to the Chinese.
Yeah.
But their coming to the West Coast led many papers to dub them the Hindu invasion or the Dusky Peril.
Excuse me? Dusky.
Dusky Peril.
Go fuck yourselves.
Right.
Oh my God.
So guess how many people constituted this like perilous invasion?
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Just for some background, there were about 90,000 Chinese people in the country at the time.
Okay.
So how many do you think were from South Asia?
South Asia. Or like we're talking from India. The whole country. In the United States, I mean.
Yes, the whole country. This invasion.
I would say an invasion in white people terms, 1,500.
Oh, okay. It's a little more than that.
Okay.
It's 8,000.
Still very low considering the entire country.
Entire country.
Pearls clutched.
Clutched. Grabbed. These
dusky motherfuckers.
Can you believe that? Dusky? Fuck off. South Asian folks just minding their business, living their lives. They were driven out of cities all up and down the West Coast, even as far as into Vancouver. Like, they were doing this shit in Canada, just like chasing out like Indian people. You know, they just didn't like the look of them. And the newspapers, they ran celebratory headlines after the fact. Like, it was such a cultural phenomenon that everyone was united against this very small group of people.
Yeah.
So under pressure from a powerful white nationalist hate group called the Asiatic Exclusion League.
It's like Asiatic Exclusion League.
At least you're saying what you're doing.
Yeah,
I mean.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
I get it. I'm a little slow today.
It's all right. So this group was pushing Congress on revising the naturalization process to specifically exclude a group of people.
I mean, in this country, never.
Yeah.
We could never.
So Congress passed the Naturalization Act of 1906, and it was signed into law by our good friend T.R.,
Teddy Roosevelt.
What a guy. So this act, it restricted naturalization only to white people and black people only.
Shocking.
Yeah. So it excluded all Asian people from a path to citizenship.
Wait, so black people were allowed to immigrate? Or they just were considered...
They were allowed to be naturalized.
I see.
I'm going to get into this later. But yeah, black people from Africa, but also descendants of Africans.
Sure. Okay.
So this is the vibe on the ground when Bhagat Singh Thind arrived in the States. Mm-hmm. He had no idea that there was this hostility towards, you know, brown people like him. I found a quote from another Punjabi man named Vaishnav Bagai, who owned a general store in California at the time. He said before immigrating that, "I don't want to stay in this slave country. I want to go to America."
What?
Well, he also was high caste in India.
Girl, stay where you are.
But the British.
I mean, yeah.
The British essentially put themselves on top of the caste.
Sure. They didn't know.
Great marketing. This country has great marketing.
I mean, everyone is equal. It's fine. It's fine.
Liberty and justice for all. Uh-huh. Justice. So Bagai and his family would later face a pretty rude awakening when they moved to California because they had bought a house. Wow. Like sight unseen. I don't know if they bought it
on Trulia. They were
they bought it on Trulia. They were shopping around on Zillow. They found a space. They bought it. They traveled. And when they tried to move in, their white neighbors barred them from moving into the house that they bought.
Not shocking at all.
But I'm going to be looping back to this man. I'm going to put a pin in this for now. So quick background on Bhagat Singh Thind. He was born into a high caste in the Punjab region of northern India. Mm-hmm. In 1913, as a 21-year-old, he was inspired by the works of Emerson and Thoreau to move here for university. He's just like, these men like love our philosophy, like they're embracing us, like this is going to be great. He wanted to study like anthropology and spirituality. So he's like, yeah, let's do this. This mm-hmm. is going to be amazing. So a year later, he moved and he started to go to the University of California at Berkeley.
Okay.
And in the summers, like he was paying his own way. In the summers, he worked at a lumber mill to pay for his education.
Sure.
Like he had enough money to move here, but like he didn't have it like that.
Yeah, you gotta work.
So when the war started in 1917, so did the draft, because he was not a citizen. He was ineligible for the draft.
He wanted to. Wow, okay.
Yeah.
I mean, he thought that he was going to be a part of this.
Yeah. So at 25, he just decided to enlist. He volunteered to be part of the U.S. Army. He was a practicing Sikh, even though he was a Hindu by the U.S. government's standards. He received special permission to wear his turban as part of his religious faith while in service.
Really? So and they were like cool with that.
He was the first. Like he made history being the first person, the first like Sikh officer in the U.S. Army.
Incredible.
So there's like really cool pictures of him. I mean, he looks amazing.
Yeah.
Like, wow. Yeah. So he was honorably discharged after the end of the war. When he joined, there was only like, I think, 4 months left of the war. He didn't know that the war was winding down. The war as like in the context of the Americans joining. We joined so late. Mm-hmm. So he was honorably discharged at the end. And his white superiors commended his excellent character.
Well,
la-ti-da, right?
Ooh, la-ti-da.
So after his discharge, he applied for citizenship in the state of Washington. He was kind of up and down for work, the West Coast. Like, he was working in Oregon, and sometimes he was working in Washington State. So he's just like, you know, let's apply in Washington State. Let's see. So since other South Asian applicants in Washington had been granted citizenship, he really thought nothing of it. He's like, I got this. Mm-hmm. So he too was approved by a district court in Washington. He was granted citizenship, but his status was very short-lived. The Bureau...
Can they take it back?
They sure can. The Bureau of Naturalization, who knew that they could do this, they appealed the district court's decision, and Thind's citizenship was revoked 4 days later. So I think it's that everything is filtered through the Department of Naturalization.
Sure.
So, like, every little state in their little district can approve it. But then the final say is like the U.S. government.
I see. Okay. So it was like pre-approved, but not
officially
approved.
But like technically approved. But yeah, kind of. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
There was this extra step.
This man was a veteran.
I know. Who volunteered, wasn't drafted, volunteered to lose his life for this country that he wasn't even technically a part of. Yeah. So the Bureau of Naturalization, they appealed the district court's decision based on the grounds that Thind was not a white man.
And? Go on.
Period. The end. A few months later, he's just like, okay, Washington State is on some bullshit. Let's try the neighbor. Let's try Oregon. Let's see what happens.
Do you know about Oregon, girl?
He's new here. Leave him alone. So once again, he was approved by the district court, but then he was denied by the same naturalization official who rejected the last claim in Washington State.
Okay.
I'm just like, was this guy just waiting to see a turban come through? I think he was.
I mean, it sounds like it. Yeah. Like,
so this court was, this case was kicked to the Supreme Court because we can't just have this man bouncing around every state trying to become a citizen and getting rejected by the same man.
Yeah.
It's just, it's all trash. Like, I guess I don't really want to get off on a tangent, but like, I don't know. The fact that Europe and Asia sit on the same landmass, yet are considered two different continents, mm-hmm. has never sat well with me.
Yeah.
Like, what the fuck are we doing here? Yeah, and like,
where do you arbitrarily draw the border between one versus the other?
I have just like a side note in my notes that says, maps, mess. So, central to to Thind's case would be the Naturalization Act of 1906 that I mentioned before, which restricted naturalization to, quote, free white persons, as well as aliens of African nativity and persons of African descent. So people born in Africa.
Sure.
And then, yeah.
I just don't.
The words is, yeah.
But I also don't understand, like, if we're just going to be like, it's only black or only white, but like, what about everyone else?
What about them?
But I guess my confusion is like, why even include Africa then if we're going to do it like that? I mean, there's so many black people here already, yeah. I guess.
I think that's what it is. Yeah. It's just a numbers thing. They're the biggest populations.
Yeah.
So Thind was not the first legal challenge to this Asian exclusion. Once these laws went into place, barring a whole continent, I guess, stupid, whole continent, Asian people like Wan Kim Ark were like, mm-hmm. what the fuck? Like,
yeah.
Get out of here. Like, excuse you? If you don't know who that is, you need to listen to episode 17 to learn all about the homie Ark and also about Obama's tan suit.
Yeah. Yes.
It's such a great episode. If you have not listened, treat yourself.
Yeah, that's a good one.
And I feel like now is time for a little pause. So if you haven't listened to that episode, this is your chance.
I need another one of these drinks, too, same. While we're taking a little breaksy, a breaksy poo. Okay, BRB.
Bye.
So, have you ever thought about what would happen if your airline window popped out?
Or if you can build a jetpack using only machine guns?
Well, we found out you could, but you really shouldn't. Hi, I'm Jill Chacha.
And I'm Marissa Riley.
Together, we have one comedy science-y show called, well, that's interesting.
It's for folks who like to learn about weird stuff, like how hair can grow between your teeth and what happens if the moon disappears.
If you need a break from the world or need interesting stuff to bring up at a party when those happen again, come on by.
Find Well That's Interesting wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Okay, we're back. Oh my. This cocktail, this is like one of my favorite cocktails this season.
Yeah, I agree.
Oh, so, it's so good.
So refreshing.
I can certainly understand why this was so popular in the 20s.
Speaking of the 20s.
Ooh.
No, in 1922, only 3 months before Thind's case was kicked to the Supreme Court, they presided over Ozawa versus the United States, in which the plaintiff defended himself as a free white person under the Naturalization Act. And therefore, he said that he was eligible for citizenship.
Okay.
His name was Takao Ozawa.
Uh-huh.
He was
so they were like, no, no.
kind of.
They're like, nice try.
There's a buzzing sound. Yeah. Try again.
The floor drops.
He's like, John Smith.
You got it.
The floor drops. So his name was Takao Ozawa. He was a Japanese man who decided to apply for citizenship after being in the United States for 20 years. He had lived here for 20 years. He had started a family. He had converted to fucking Christianity. And he spoke flawless English. his defense highlighted these qualities, as well as Ozawa's light skin, as proof that he was a white person.
Yeah.
He's like, I've done all the things that all the, like, I'm doing what Chad is doing. I have light skin. Like,
I know what I'm supposed to do to be included in this country. Yes. So I'm going to play the game, and I'm playing it.
I'm playing it. But the Supreme Court unanimously disagreed. They said a Japanese born in Japan, being clearly not Caucasian, cannot be made a citizen of the United States.
Gross.
So according to them, he was Mongolian. Based on the racial, air quotes around racial classifications of the day.
So we got Hindus and we got Mongolians.
Yes. It's called science, okay? yes, it's pseudo. Shut up. Next question.
That's the best kind.
Yes. It's next gen. It's 2.0. Get on our level, okay? So this ruling legally equated Caucasian with being a white person.
Sure.
Yeah. So this precedent gave Thind's lawyer, a man named Sakaram Pandit, grounds to argue for his client's citizenship.
Okay.
He was like, oh, we're talking Caucasians? Like, my client is Caucasian.
Yeah.
Your Honor. Like, we got this. So the U.S. versus Bhagat Singh Thind was framed around two specific questions. The first question was, is a high caste Hindu, air quotes around Hindu, uh-huh, born in the Punjab region of India, a white person?
Mm-hmm.
Riddle me that. The second was, does the current Immigration Act disqualify from naturalization those, quote, Hindus who arrived here prior to the act going into effect?
Huh. Okay.
He was kind of asking, like, I've been here for a while. Like, I know that you just made this ruling, but, like, I got here before the ruling. Like, what say you?
Yeah.
Can I be naturalized?
I mean,
like, fuck all these other Indian people coming behind me. But, like, can I? Like, we're just talking about me. Like, let's talk about me.
No, let's be real for a minute.
Yes, totally.
Back in India, I'm up here.
Yes.
I got some money.
Yes.
I'm at the top of the heap.
Mm-hmm.
Me?
Mm-hmm. Come on. His defense was, come on.
The old come on defense.
I mean,
an oldie but a goodie.
So Pandit, his lawyer, he argued that while Thind was not pale in complexion, because he was very clearly a brown man, Thind was racially Caucasian, making him a white person under the decision that was just set down a few months prior in Ozawa.
Okay.
That, like, a white person means Caucasian. Like, he's Caucasian, therefore he's a white person.
What, I mean, who decided, like, so what is the textbook definition of Caucasian?
I'm going to get there.
Thank you, because I'm confused.
Going, thank you. Your confusion is warranted because it's confusing.
It don't make no sense.
I mean, it's fabrication. Yeah, it's lies. Clearly. So he was saying that his client is Caucasian, therefore should be naturalized in this process.
Okay.
This prior ruling said that this man was not a white person because he wasn't Caucasian.
Mm-hmm.
So
now we've got a brown man who is Caucasian. Yes. So riddle me this.
Exactly. So the use of Caucasian to mean white was popularized in the late 18th century by a man named Johann Friedrich Blumenbach.
Ooh la la.
He was a very creepy German anthropologist.
Mm-hmm.
The dude,
I'm picturing, like, mutton chops or something.
I mean, I didn't look at his face, but I'm just assuming that's what it is.
Yeah.
Really, really weird vibe. He once wrote that the Caucasian skull of the Georgian female was the most handsome and becoming.
Okay, girl.
So you are a serial killer.
Yeah. What a handsome skull you have.
Yeah. And, like, also, how'd you get the skull? That was my question.
Well, like, he's an anthropologist. They're digging up skulls left and right.
Yeah, that's true, I guess. But I'm just like,
he's knee deep in skulls.
This guy feels like a creep. Like,
totally. Like anyone who's knee deep in skulls.
Yeah, you're right. So the term, according to him, included all white Europeans and the people of the region reaching from, this is a quote, from the Obi River in Russia to the Ganges in India and Bangladesh to the Caspian Sea in Iran, with just, like, Northern Africans mixed in for, like, spice, kind of.
Mm, good times.
He's just, like, drawing a circle around where he thinks white-skinned people are.
Sure.
And that's
and there's science. there's some brown people in the fringes.
Yes, in the northern regions of India and Bangladesh.
Sure, okay.
But it's just like you clearly have never been to India or Bangladesh, because it's like these even people in the are north,
probably white. They're
wrong, actually. Yeah, but wrong. It's the fucking continent, and like I get what he's saying because he's never been to these places, but he's just like, it's all one thing, so like let's just circle the north of this one thing.
Totally.
And these people are the same trash, just like
just as I thought.
So North India was included in this Caucasian region of people, according to the foremost expert, Mr. Creepy Skull. So this argument was a popular one. It's why most South Asian Americans were awarded citizenship prior to Thind.
Oh, okay.
So his lawyer presented this background on these previous cases, like in court. He then reiterated the precedent set by Ozawa that white means Caucasian. He talked about Thind's military commendations that he got while serving in the army. And then to really prove that he was white, he took a dump on those born in the lowest caste before resting his case, because, you know, that's what you do. In the last part of his defense, Thind said, this is a quote from his own mouth, the high class Hindu, referring to himself, bitch, you're six, but it's okay, regards the aboriginal Indian mongoloid,
oh my God,
yuck, in the same manner as the American, meaning the white American, regards the Negro. Speaking from a matrimonial standpoint.
Matrimonial?
Well, he's saying that, like, rape is okay, but marriage isn't in India of the lowest caste.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Like, we're not going to marry them. Okay,
I see. Yes, we'll, yeah.
It's illegal to marry them. Down,
but we're not going to.
Yes.
We're not going to put a ring on it.
Yes. So he goes on to say, the caste system prevails in India to a degree unsurpassed elsewhere. Like, dude, you're bragging about a caste system? But he wasn't wrong, and also it was the 1920s. Like, this is the argument you make to win.
Well, and he had eyes. He's like, y'all have the same shit here.
Yeah. I mean, he's saying that his shit is better in India, unsurpassed elsewhere. Uh-huh. But, like, yeah, he's saying that, like, I know this. I know the gag. Like, I am you.
Yeah.
Me.
Same.
You know, when in doubt, just praise the caste system that you want to be a part of.
Yeah.
I think it's a winning strategy. So the American racial caste put South Asian Americans somewhere in the middle between, you know, white the top and black the bottom. Mm-hmm. So in order to rise above your station, you have to just shit on who's below you. Like,
totally.
This is the way. Like, he's picked up on, I mean, because he grew up in a caste system, he knows what you have to do to climb it. You know, it's the fastest way to belonging, really. But I get it. He had traveled far. He just wanted to be as comfortable here as he was in India. It's kind of shitty, but, like, I understand why he did what he did.
No, I mean, it's garbage, but it totally makes sense that it's like, yeah, he thought that he was coming to somewhere that would be even more comfortable because the British weren't occupying.
Yes.
It's garbage, but, like, it is garbage. What it is.
Yeah. It's garbage, but we can understand, right?
I mean, we've lived it our whole lives.
Yeah, we've lived it our whole lives. So we get, how he was trying to maneuver in this new but also old system.
Yeah.
You know? So a month after closing arguments, on February 19th, 1923, the Supreme Court handed down its decision. They unanimously came back with the ruling that essentially said, bing bong, what the fuck out of here. Like, you are not one of us. You're not one of us. Yeah. They said that Hindu people weren't white, therefore could not be citizens.
But were they Caucasian?
So, the court acknowledged the argument of Thind as a Caucasian, but went on to say, this is amazing, what we now hold is that the words of the free white persons are the words of common speech, to be interpreted in accordance with the understanding of the common man, synonymous with the word Caucasian only as that word is popularly understood. Meaning that free white persons are too dumb to realize who's Caucasian and who isn't.
Uh-huh. They're basically like, maybe you are technically Caucasian, but that's not what we meant. We meant, like,
no, they're saying that you are Caucasian, but, like, dumb white people don't know that you are.
Yeah.
So we're going to use the popular understanding of the word Caucasian.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because we the court represent the fucking
people. Because also that's when they said Caucasian in the other ruling, that's what they meant.
Yes.
We meant white Caucasian.
Yes. Facts. Snaps to that. Yeah. Yes. It's so funny because they had just ruled that, like, to be
literally
white
just done it
3 months prior. 3 months.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
But they're just like, JK, LOL.
Like, we said Caucasian, but we meant, like, Caucasian like us.
But we meant, like, not Indian.
Yeah. Yeah. We meant the kind of Caucasian that you aren't.
Oh, my God. Yes, totally. So, just in case it wasn't crystal clear, the hypocrisy of these, you know, contradictory rulings that were literally months apart, I have a fun quote from the opinion that read, "The children of English, French, German, Italian, Scandinavian, and other European parentage quickly merge into the mass of our population and lose the distinctive hallmarks of their European origin. On the other hand, it cannot be doubted that the children born in this country of Hindu parents would retain indefinitely the clear evidence of their ancestry."
Skin color.
Yes.
But also, what the fuck are you talking about that Europeans lose the, what was it again?
They lose distinctive hallmarks of their European origin.
What the fuck does that mean? I mean, we're talking about people that have Germans that have Oktoberfest. I grew up going to Oktoberfest as a German American.
I mean, they kind of get they mean like not just first generation or second generation.
Sure. Yeah.
Actually, I mean, I guess starting to talk about the second generation when you're just white.
Yeah.
And Target is your god.
Yeah. I mean, I certainly love Target. But I also love pretzels. Yeah. So
I feel like you have more connection than most people.
My family
more
is,
than most people.
Yeah. There's so many directly German people in my family that I have a much closer connection to that part of my heritage than most
part
people
of
do.
Your culture. So the Naturalization Act of 1906 made no mention of assimilation as like a requirement for naturalization. But like, okay, go off, SCOTUS. Like, you know, talk that spicy talk.
They get to decide. They're like, no, we forgot to put that in the first one.
I mean,
it was just like, we meant to, but we just forgot.
And that's like the shape-shifting thing of whiteness right there.
And the Supreme Court.
Yeah. So the Supreme Court's choice to like add these remarks to their opinion shows that the U.S. government truly defined as white just to mean conformity.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I thought we were individuals. So the court was saying that Thind and his children and his children's children and his children's children's children would, in effect, retain an unacceptable reminder of the world outside of whiteness, i.e., you know, a collective culture, brown skin, turbans, like spicy, delicious food, a religion that is peaceful and just sees
that's
divinity.
That's what this is all about, and everything. Is seasoning.
Yeah.
I mean, like, we can't have you seasoning your food.
Right? Black pepper is spicy enough. So the Supreme Court verdict is showed that, you know, whiteness is not this scientific category. I mean, we all fucking know that, right? But it's this, you know, it's this fabricated power construct that, you know, it's a concept that can be altered to exclude the people we want to exclude.
Well, and that's the
and
whole point is like
to fit the people we want to expand.
Yeah. If you try to define it scientifically, it's going to include somebody you don't want it to. So it has to be fluid. Yeah. It has to be malleable.
It has to be something that can be expanded at will to keep a majority.
Or contracted at will.
Or contracted at will to just keep certain people, you know, disenfranchised.
Exactly.
And outside of the system. I think I'm going to do a mini about the census. It might be too big. I don't know if you're aware that, like, Afghanis and, like, people from the Ukraine, they're both white by the census.
Yeah, that, I mean, they're I'm not surprised white. By that.
Yeah. And I'm just so curious to know, and I don't think we have the numbers because, you know, it's by design, to know, like, what is the real population of whiteness? subtracting out all the white Latinas, you know, what Latinx folks that, you know, that speak Spanish and like have culture, subtracting out the North Africans, the people from like Yemen, like, or the people from fucking Bangladesh who are considered white, like, what is the real population of whiteness in this country? Is it what, like 30%? 35%?
If
you subtract all out, like the Turk, like the people with culture, just leave the white people. What does that look like? 2022. Like, what does that population look like based on the last census? I don't think they're the majority.
Well, this is the whole thing is like, as we've said throughout this whole thing is like, it's fluid. You can say
it's fluid because it's fabricated,
but it is being used to someone's advantage.
Yeah.
It's and power it can play. Be fluid in one way or the other, depending on what you're trying to prove.
Yes.
Or what you're trying to like put forth.
The one thing I love about New York, and I think it's very, very unique globally to New York, that you could be here, like you could get off the plane at JFK. You don't even need an apartment. You can be in New York and feel like a New Yorker and claim New York. Like, I'm going to live here. This is going to be my city. You can't really do that outside of anywhere. Because it's like, oh, where are you really from?
Yeah. I mean, New York is, it takes a certain kind of mindset to be able to thrive in New York.
Absolutely.
But it doesn't matter who you are, where you come from.
Yeah.
You just have to have the right mentality.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what your skin color is.
If you feel like a New Yorker, you can be a New Yorker.
Exactly.
There are people that I've met who, like, I have friends who are from, like, the north of Italy who've moved to Rome, which is, like, I guess technically the south or the central part of Italy, who moved to Rome. They feel like outsiders.
Mm-hmm.
In a new city in Rome.
Yeah, totally.
And they're like, oh, it's because your parents are from the north. And it's like, who fucking cares?
Jesus. You're
the north meaning 2 hours from here? Like, fuck out of here.
Yeah.
It's such a small country. But like, there are these like, yeah, it's weird. Nowhere is perfect. But New York is I think a really unique microcosm of like, you can just... If you feel like New York, if you feel the spirit, you can claim it.
You have it in you, though. Like, New York is a hard fucking place to live.
But no one's going
to
check you,
really. No. In New York will check you. The city will kick your fucking ass.
An individual person will check you. But an individual person in Rome will check you. They'll hear your accent.
Yeah.
And it's very similar to, like, the UK. Mm-hmm. It's, like, very accent-driven.
Yeah.
It's like,
you're from Liverpool.
Get out of here.
Yeah. You're a Scouser.
I don't even know what that means, but yes, totally. I like that we've completely got off track.
For a good many minutes.
Okay, so the fallout. The fallout of the verdict.
Oh, there's more of that.
There's more. So following
I thought we were done.
No, we are not done. Following the Supreme Court's decision, Thind's citizenship was revoked again for the third time. He's no longer a citizen again. So not only were new citizens not granted, because of this ruling, not granted citizenship, 65 South Asian Americans were retroactively stripped of their citizenship.
What?
Including his lawyer, Pandit.
Fuck! Oh my God.
They stripped his lawyer of his citizenship.
How can you do that? You already said yes.
So South Asian Americans instantly became the target of many different states, just like bureaucracy. In California specifically, there was this law called the California Alien Land Law. It prohibited, quote, aliens ineligible for citizenship from having long-term leases. So South Asians who had land here had to give their land to their white neighbors. Give, not sell. You know, as one does, bootstraps. So after the ruling, there was a man who was the attorney general in California at the time. His name was Ulysses Webb. I'm like, you sound like a Ulysses. He declared that the menacing spread of Hindus holding our land will cease. Holding the land that they bought will cease? Okay, cool. So for many South Asian Americans, returning to India was not an option because a lot of them fled British rule.
Sure.
And were very anti-colonialist.
Mm-hmm. So they came here?
They didn't know. But they came here. They moved to California. They fucking went to Berkeley. And then they started to talk that spicy anti-colonials talk. Mm-hmm. And like, things would be too hot for them if they went back.
Yeah.
So I mentioned Vaishnu Bagai. He was that general store manager in California who bought a house here. Mm-hmm. And mess. So he was forced to hand over his store and the profits of his store to a white acquaintance.
Acquaintance?
Yeah. He later committed suicide.
Yeah.
Because he knew that he couldn't go back to India because he'd been involved with this like revolutionary party once he got here that was, you know, anti-colonialist and was pushing for change in India. He knew that if he went back, him and his family would be killed.
Unbelievable.
He wrote this suicide note, and it's so, so like heart annihilating. Like I cried when I read it. It was so poetically and like powerfully written. He talked about living in a gilded cage. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I know what you mean.
Yeah.
So Thin, he not to be deterred, he petitioned for naturalization a third time in New York, this time in 1935, after Congress passed an act which allowed World War I veterans eligible for naturalization to become citizens, regardless of race. So it took almost two decades, but he finally did it. He became a citizen. He quickly married a white woman who was 19 years his junior. He had a bunch of kids. He got his PhD in like Eastern philosophy. He started, you know, teaching the white people about, you know, what they wanted to learn. Like, it was great. He lived a really, really good life. He taught on Sikh philosophy and spirituality. So in the aftermath of the U.S. versus Thind, that decision, South Asian Americans, like the community really kind of dwindled, obviously. You know, by 1940, the numbers were reduced by half because these people weren't allowed to be citizens. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people who got here, they're just like, fuck this. Like, I'll just go back. Like, I don't want to be stuck here. The ones who had the means to return, they just left. So the support for South Asians, they increased after World War II due to the strategic position of India at the time.
Of course. Yeah. Right. Yeah. We've done this before.
Yeah. We know this game. That's when we start to like people, when we mm-hmm. need something from
yeah,
them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So in 1946, the Loose Seller Act was passed, and it allowed Indian Americans to become citizens. But they set an annual quota of 100 Indian people a year.
100 for the whole country?
Correct.
Jesus Christ. What is wrong with us? What?
100, right? So after William Peterson, and he's like some sort of, I guess, novelist, writer fellow, he wrote an infamous article concerning the success post-internment of Japanese Americans. It turns out trauma is really good for conformity.
Uh-huh. Imagine.
Right? So soon the perception of Asian Americans as a whole shifted from, like, you know, dusky and yellow mm-hmm. and being perilous and, like, being this horde of people to just, you know, we love you now. You're great. You're the model minority.
Exactly. We need to
once
use
we traumatize you,
as a, yeah.
and you conform to our will,
then we can hold you up as an example against other.
Yes, we can use you as a stick to beat others with.
Yes.
So they were going up the ladder. They started in, you know, poor urban neighborhoods in Chinatowns, in areas that were, you know, largely black and brown, and they, you know, they ascended. They got out of these inner cities. They moved to white suburbs. It's called brown flight. I didn't know about this. This is a phenomenon, especially on the West Coast of like, you know, Asian people moving to be closer to white people. So the Immigration and Naturalization Act of 1965, it revamped this quota system. They're like, okay, 100 is stupid. Like, we need to stop. Like, hello. Come on now.
Yeah.
This is not enough. So they completely changed the system. It was now going to be instead
150.
Of this, instead of this quota, like 100 sort of system, they made it a skill-based system. So they wanted to increase the South Asian immigration. So new immigrants were no longer these agricultural laborers. Mm-hmm. It was no longer the give me you're tired, you're hungry, you're poor. It was give me your best and brightest.
Exactly.
So today, nearly a century post, it's 99 years since the ruling. There are approximately 5.4 million South Asians in the U.S. And we really... That's a lot of people.
Yeah.
And yet we don't learn about this episode in history, this piece of South Asian American history, because it is embarrassing. It's embarrassing kind of for all the parties involved.
Yeah, totally.
However, I recently saw a quote from a woman named Daska Pillai. She wrote this really, it's going to be in the show notes, really thoughtful, like, dissection of this ruling.
Okay.
It's like 20 pages long. It's really incredible. Great citations. Like I learned a lot from her writing. She said that the history that is not known reveals more than the history that is.
Yeah, totally.
I'm going to end this here at the end.
That's, yeah.
Right? I'm like, I don't know if I've ever read truer words. The history that is not known reveals more about the history that is.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for telling that story. That's, yeah. I mean, this country.
No.
Oh, man. I don't even know.
But I think it's good to know this.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Right? 100%. My cocktail. Oh, my goodness. I'm feeling it. This is delicious.
It's really,
and
really good.
Intoxicating.
Uh-oh.
It is an intoxicating liqueur.
Wait. Intoxicating liquor? What?
Liquor. Thank you guys for listening to Beyond Reproach. This has been Tux Lerzel.
It's been Stephanie Domingo.
America's history is juicy. We just add gin.
Yeah.
And some like raspberry syrup.
Not the syrup.
Thank you to Tim Clough, our editor, sound engineer, and podfather. We could not do this without you.
It would be impossible.
Impossible. If it were up to me, I would allow him to be a citizen. Good thing he already is. Thanks, guys.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Beyond Reproach is proudly recorded in Bushwick, Brooklyn, on land belonging to the Lenape Nation. Please note that we are not historians. We're just a couple of drunks who never shut up and love history. A full list of all source information can be found in the show notes on our website. Please take a moment to rate, review, and subscribe. And remember that written reviews are especially important. If you like us, please do one of two things. Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, or send this episode to a friend, family member, or someone who you think would be into it. Don't forget to follow us on social media, and make sure you follow us on Instagram, because we post our cocktail recipes the Thursday before each full episode. Please drink along with us if you are not driving. We also have a shop at beyondreproachpod.com. Get your merch, brand yourselves, and we have exclusive content on Patreon where you can directly support the production of our show.